The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
What is it?
There is something.
I feel it too. A scent in the air. Like death.
You are surprised that I would help to finance Abbot Orland's ascension?
That is the business of the Abelicans. I do not understand why we should choose to get involved.
Our relationship with the Abelicans will prove of utmost importance in the crucial time that will soon be before us. All is in place. I will be reborn, and you will be there to watch over me until we are again united. I know this because I have been reborn time and time again. And after you witness the great transcendence, you will rest easier at night, in full confidence that Yatol is with us every step.
Welcome, fiends.
I have seen the chi. I have touched the chi. I have grasped it. I know it.
I had hoped that you would see it, Paganel. It is good that you have, for now there is a road before you.
I would walk the path of all colors, Master Chaos.
You understand the danger?
To wait is folly, for I am prepared.
Have you determined your road beyond that?
Dogai. I have seen the steps and the grasses in my dreams, and I know that I must return there.
Don't miss part one of the Demon Wars Saga Book 6, Transcendence. Available now in graphic audio.
What's happened?
Empire Line's Princess Philomena just arrived in system, squalling like a banshee. Apparently, the pirates hit Bissonette and have taken over the government. Blew through the planetary space militia as if they weren't there.
This is more than one pirate gang could do. It'd take a space fleet near enough.
Do they have a name for themselves?
The Deep Space Benevolent Association, commanded by one Gamus Turek. What are you going to do about this fellow?
Kill him! When we can, at least.
Your niece Kai has a letter of marque.
She what? You just made her more of a target. There's no way she can fight effectively with that old crate she's in. And now you've given our enemies even more reason to go after her.
When I watched her for the year she was at the Academy, she'll make a better privateer than regular officer, actually. Intelligent, quick, capable, and if I'm not mistaken, has the true killer instinct.
I hope not.
Captain Vada, you've heard about the Philomena, of course.
Yes.
Captain Bisden says the pirates had a whole fleet, 14 ships at least.
I know. What we need is a true interstellar force. I'm thinking of the other privateers. We need to find them, get them working with us. I think it's essential.
I don't see how. We don't even know where the others are, and I don't know how to fight a fleet action.
I do.
A lone assassin?
Miss Grace!
Caitlin, go in the kitchen and stay there.
The police!
Don't call them. Helen, how bad is it?
Not hurt, just stunned. Char?
Get Justin inside if you can. I'll get Char. Sorry. Easy now, Buttercup. Char, it's time to go in.
What happened to Rosie? Did you shoot Rosie? Bad word! Grandma said...
Stay down, Char. Stay flat and be quiet, and hold still no matter what. You!
You're having an interesting morning. Stay with me now, come on.
Vata's War, Book 3, Engaging the Enemy, Part 1. In graphic audio.
And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, Tony Nam, Colleen Delaney, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Tim Getman, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, M.J. Casey, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 22, Brutal Conquest. Struck the engine of the helicopter's main rotor. Nearly as quickly, the just-rescued women panicked. The storm was upon them before there was time to think, time to react, or time to take any form of evasive action.
We are going down!
John Rourke pushed to his feet, Michael a step ahead of him.
Paul! Annie! Try to keep these women calm so we can hear ourselves think! Get them into crash positions! Hurry!
One of the overhead electrical panels caught fire. Michael grabbed the bulkhead-mounted extinguisher.
Get back! I've got to put the fire out! Get back!
John Rourke pushed past his son into the Eden gunship's cockpit. All around them, there was green-tinged blackness.
It was just here, John! A moment ago, it was clear all around us. Then we were into the storm. We still have tail rotor control, but I don't know how much longer. We're going to crash!
John Rourke reached around Natalia, grabbing for the joystick. It moved too easily.
Damn it!
Freezing rain and hail enveloped them, one of the overhead cockpit bubble panels cracking, spider-webbing under the repeated impact from balls of ice that were nearly the size of baseballs. Rourke lurched into the co-pilot seat beside her, buckling in as he started hitting switches on the auxiliary control panel. His hand closed over hers on the joystick, feeling for a response from the controls. There was none.
I was in terrain following to avoid a lightning strike, but it did not...
Can you still control the tail at all, Natalia?
Not enough! Hold on!
John Rourke's mind raced, searching for a solution, but there was none. He braced.
Impact's coming up! Brace yourself!
The helicopter was skidding along the ground, starting to turn over.
All fuel supply systems are off!
The helicopter turned onto its side, blades from the main rotor slicing past them along the ground, shattering the chin bubble. John Rourke hung over the right side of the co-pilot seat. A piece of one of the main rotor blades, twisted and gnarled, punched through the chin bubble inches from his left leg. He looked up and to his left. Natalia, unmoving, hung suspended from her seat restraint. Rourke reached for the quick release buckle of his harness, but it was jammed. The smell of burning insulation was even stronger now. He shook his head to clear it.
How is it back there?
Some injuries. I don't think anyone's dead.
John Rourke had the little AG Sting 1A black chrome in his hand and was using it to cut through the webbing of the seat restraint.
Natalia! Natalia, answer me! Come on, wake up, Natalia.
We are alive.
This thing's on fire and we gotta get out of here in order to stay alive. Think now, come on!
Natalia's seat restraint release buckle worked, and as he activated it, she fell from the pilot seat and into his arm. Rourke held her for an instant. He loved her. He always would. But he loved his wife. Natalia was Michael's woman now. And although he would never stop loving her, he was happy for them. For both of them. Natalia's eyelids fluttered as he set her down against the side of the co-pilot seat. As he sheathed his knife, he gazed at the incredible blueness of her eyes.
Can you walk?
Yes, I am all right. Help the others.
Rourke pulled her to her feet and she swayed against him. Then he pushed her aft, ducking her head down for her as she turned sideways to get through. There was smoke here, dense and acrid smelling. Michael, his head bleeding, was handing some of the injured women out of the main compartment and up to Paul and Annie, who hung down through where the portside fuselage door had been, now a jagged tear. There was a hole in the overhead, now to Rourke's left because the craft was turned on its side, where the main rotor assembly had been sheared away. Martin, the neo-Nazi leader of Eden, the son taken from John and Sarah in the instant of birth, pushed past one of the injured women and started to clamber up toward the opening where Paul and Annie were. John Rourke straight-armed Martin in the chest, spinning him around.
Help these people! Now, damn it!
Rourke grabbed Martin by the front of his shirt.
Help him, or you'll die.
Martin reached down to one of the women. She visibly recoiled from him, but he grabbed her up, starting to hand her out to Paul and Annie. Rourke's eyes scanned the cabin. Despite the smoke, the recurrent lightning flashes allowed him to see clearly enough. And red panic lights glowed from the bulkhead and overhead receptacles, others blown out or shattered. There was a woman with a piece of shrapnel sticking through her left arm. Rourke pushed away debris, dropped to his knees, and quickly set to work. He had to free her arm from the shrapnel. A piece of the fuselage body twisted inward before he could carry her out. The smoke was getting thicker as he braced his left knee against her left shoulder, then grasped her arm to raise it off the metal spike.
I'm a doctor. You'll be all right.
He only hoped he was right.
Tell me your blood type in case you pass out. Blood type. Come on, come on. O, A, B, what is it?
Oh, positive, I think.
Good girl. Don't be afraid to scream. It'll help.
He took a glove from his pocket and put it between her teeth.
Fight. Now.
Then he had her free. He reached to his snow smock, ripping away the left sleeve at the shoulder. Then turning it inside out and twisting it, binding it above her wound as a tourniquet.
I've got the medical kit they had in there. All our stuff's out.
Get Martin out of here and tell Annie to keep an eye on him. If he runs, kneecap him.
Right.
Get Natalia out and get her to sit down someplace. It might be a concussion. What about the rest of the women?
All of them out. No dead.
This one's gonna need a transfusion. Find somebody with O positive and see if you can scrounge up some fuel line or something for the transfusion.
Right.
How's your head?
John Rourke had the woman bandaged and was staunching the flow of blood.
Just a scratch, but it's bleeding a lot. I'm fine.
Head wounds can be serious. I'll take a look in a minute.
Rourke looked back over his shoulder. Martin was scrambling out, and Michael was helping Natalia into Paul's hands. He pulled her up, and she was out. Then Michael dropped to one knee beside John Rourke and the injured woman.
I'll give you a hand.
All right, take that side. Watch your arm.
They lifted her between them.
Paul, give us a hand!
They pushed the woman up as Paul extended his hands, grabbing her left side, holding her as Michael eased himself up and out through the opening. John Rourke pushed upward on the woman's body, and Paul and Michael had her. Rourke took a quick glance around the cabin.
Michael! Paul!
Yeah!
Sure you have everything?
Everything, Dad.
Rourke reached up, grabbed a handhold, and started to wrestle himself clear. Michael's and Paul's hands on his shoulders and upper arms, pulling him up. Rourke jumped down into the snow. The rain still fell, icy sleet, hailstones pelting the ground, striking his face. He pulled up the hood of his parka. The women, Martin Zimmer, Natalia, and Annie, were already about 30 yards from the craft. Michael and Paul jumped down, and together the three of them started away from the helicopter as quickly as they could. There was no telling if or when it would explode, and the fact that it hadn't as yet was no guarantee it wouldn't in the next second.
What do we do now, John?
Remember the old joke? What do you mean, we, pale face? Well, I don't know yet. We need shelter. Is there a survival kit?
Michael's parka caught fire.
You're caught!
Michael smothered the fire and got to his knees. John Rourke stood up, looking back. All that remained of the gunship now was a skeleton. Its missile pods were still in place, but the wiring was fused. Fortunately, none of the missiles detonated.
In answer to your question, yeah, a survival kit. Probably has some sort of shelter in it, but it can't be much.
The rain was starting to slacken, and overhead the electrical activity was subsiding, the sky lightening.
They're going to be coming, Dad.
John Rourke just nodded. Mentally, he began making a list of what had to be done in order of importance. The woman with the blood loss from the wounded arm, and the other injured to be tended to. The shelter, if there was one, could be erected to protect the more seriously injured. Meanwhile, there was the question of exposure.
Shit. Took the word right off the tip of my tongue, John. What the hell are we supposed to do with these people? I mean, where do we take them?
Find a cave, something. There's no time to talk, gentlemen.
John Rourke turned away from the wreckage and started jogging through the rocks and snow and slush. Paul had scavenged a fuel line, and after cleaning and disinfecting it, Rourke transfused little more than a pint of blood from three women among the group rescued from the stronghold of the land pirates, not wishing to weaken any of the donors seriously enough to affect survivability under the extreme conditions surrounding them. As long as Martin Zimmer was a prisoner, there would not be an outright attack by the land pirates or the Eden armed forces, but it was inevitable that some of the massive mobile fortresses were coming through the Rift Valley even now in pursuit. Their radar might have sufficient range to have detected the crash, which meant they would be coming all the faster. Natalia had been airborne for roughly 30 minutes. Rourke calculated that they had covered perhaps 50 miles, maybe as many as 60. Maximum speed for the fortresses, multi-treaded, massive armored vehicles with main decks Paul estimated to be nearly the size of a football field, could be no more than 30 miles per hour, flat out over good terrain, unless Rourke seriously misjudged their capabilities. In the Rift Valley, half that speed for vehicles of that size would be hard to maintain. But at 15 miles per hour, considering flight time and the time already spent tending the injured, the first of the fortresses would be coming into sight in 2 to 3 hours. Without shelter, he'd start losing some of the women to exposure in half that time. The women, having been kidnapped by the land pirates from communities throughout the wildlands, were already malnourished and were dressed in little better than rags, ill-suited for survival in the sub-freezing temperatures. John Rourke's parka, along with those of the others, was already gone, as were the Eden uniform parts worn by Paul and Annie and Natalia. The snow pants were given over to be used as best they could for jackets. The last of the serious wounds attended to, John Rourke stepped out of the four-man shelter and into the blast, only a heavy military-style sweater over his ordinary clothing. It was late morning, the sky gray and threatening, but the storm that had almost literally shot them out of the sky was gone. Rourke rubbed his hands over his upper arms for circulation. Annie, back in her own clothes, but minus her parka, stood holding a gun on Martin Zimmer. Rourke walked toward Michael and Paul, who were sorting the gear from the aircraft into relatively equal loads. They even had the door gun and two boxes of link belt cartridges. He joined them, his son and his best friend. Martin Zimmer. It was clear now that Dietrich Zimmer, the brilliant microsurgeon and geneticist, had planned very well up to and including faking his own death as well as that of the newborn child he had kidnapped. Zimmer had a brother, Jürgen, a confirmed neo-Nazi like Dietrich himself, dedicated to establishing a new world order. However dedicated Jürgen Zimmer had been, though, John Rourke seriously doubted the man had volunteered himself as a corpse to substitute for Dietrich. But it had to have been Jürgen Zimmer's body that, along with a lookalike for Commander Dodd, had been discovered in the wreckage of a helicopter crash. Unlike Dodd, commander of the Eden Project shuttle fleet, who was born in the 20th century before the process really progressed out of the experimental stage, there was a genetic fingerprint of Dietrich Zimmer. Genetic identification could not be rigged, but the genetic print between close members of the same family was identical. But it wasn't that simple. There was also the question of retina prints to be resolved. Yet for someone ruthless enough to murder his own brother and skilled enough as a surgeon, that was easily rectified, just as it was for someone dedicated enough to sacrifice an eye. It seemed clear that what Dietrich Zimmer had done was to have his own left eye surgically removed, then transplanted into the socket of his brother. His brother would have had to have been alive, of course, for the process to be done convincingly, and John Rourke did not want to consider the ramifications that suggested. But what had Dietrich Zimmer done to the baby he kidnapped? Dietrich Zimmer had actually stolen two children, the newborn son of Lieutenant Martha Larimore, born in the morning, and the newborn child Rourke's wife Sarah had delivered, probably only moments before Dietrich shot Sarah in the head. Dietrich Zimmer kept the child of Martha Larimore alive specifically for the purpose of killing it, to make everyone believe he had murdered the Rourke baby instead. Then Zimmer arranged to fake his own death and that of Dodd, arranged for the abortive attempt at destroying the cryogenic chambers in which John Rourke and the rest of his family slept, arranged for the successful assassination of Akira Kuranami, first elected president of Eden, and Akira's wife, Elaine Halverson. Then Dodd miraculously returned, claiming leadership of Eden, saying he himself was the victim of a neo-Nazi plot, exposing the body that was attributed to be his as that of a Nazi sympathizer in league with Dietrich Zimmer, who had really died. But clearly, Dietrich Zimmer did not die. What had he done to this man now called Martin, who was born of Sarah and himself, Rourke wondered. Psychologists had perennially battled over the effects of environment versus heredity. But could the environment Dietrich Zimmer provided have wrought so much? Martin was clearly evil, not just misguided. John Rourke reached for the helicopter's first aid kit in the same moment that Michael did, and he looked at his son. Rourke considered himself luckier than most men. Michael was fine and good and strong, courageous, and Annie, his sister, was the epitome of all that was worthwhile in a woman, courageous, resourceful, loving. John Rourke had two children in whom he took great pride. They stood beside the skeleton of the helicopter that had brought them here. Still smoldering, it provided a modicum of needed warmth. Annie was helping the women who had been rescued from the land pirates prepare for the arduous journey that lay ahead. The women now found themselves plunged into a survival situation more potentially deadly than their previous captivity. Natalia, perhaps suffering from a mild concussion, but under the circumstances well enough to travel, kept an eye on Martin. That she would use a gun, if necessary, to stop Martin from escaping was something John Rourke did not doubt for a moment. The cold was intense. Michael and Paul, stripped down to ordinary pants and heavy sweaters, like John Rourke himself, had surrendered coats and snow pants to the women in an effort to prolong stamina and guard them against exposure. When they presented their plan, John Rourke realized they had evidently worked this out in advance and were ganging up on him.
This is potential suicide, Michael.
You got a better way of buying time, Dad?
You can't do it, John. You don't have much gray in your hair, but you got enough. Michael now looks basically like you did when we first met on the night of the war. And that's exactly what Martin Zimmer looks like. That flesh wound Michael picked up on his left eye is the only thing, and he figures he can fake his way around it.
No, damn it.
At least, hear me out, Dad. If I can make them think Martin's been shot up a little and is all pissed off, they're not going to press by giving me some kind of identity quiz. As soon as they get me, give me medical attention and everything, I can order them to get me back to Eden so I can coordinate efforts to nail you guys, or something like that. I'll have to make it up as I go along, but I can convince them, make them believe I'm Martin. Once I reach Eden, I can slip away and meet you guys at the safe house.
There was a safe house set up by Allied intelligence on the outskirts of Eden City. Just how safe it might prove to be was another question.
The leg wound won't cut it. Too many people saw you get hurt, Michael.
Exactly. But that'll work, Dad. Somebody shoots me in the leg again. Michael took one round. That's assuming anyone will remember. Zimmer can take two bullet wounds. I tell them the aircraft crashed, they can see that with their own eyes, and that I stole a gun and took a couple of rounds before I was able to escape. With the helicopter gutted, I can tell them that the fire started as soon as we hit the ground, and that's how I was able to pull it off in the confusion.
You can't make them think you're Martin, Michael.
All I've got to do is be surly, right? Somebody asks me something I can't answer, I complain about my leg hurting or the head wound and tell whoever it is to shut up. That sounds like my brother. I can aim the search and destroy teams in another direction, buy you time. Otherwise, the best we can hope for is a standoff as soon as the land pirates and the Eden armed forces catch up with us holding Martin while those women we freed died of exposure. What choice do we have, Dad?
John Rourke looked at Michael, looked at him hard, then stared at Martin Zimmer, who was some distance away.
I don't like it either, John, but it'll work. I don't like it a bit.
If you can hold on to Martin, then you can use him as a bargaining chip with Dietrich Zimmer. Maybe force Dietrich into operating on Mom to get that bullet out of her brain. That's why you want Martin. You're not going to kill him no matter what he is, because he's your flesh and blood, and Mom's flesh and blood, just like Annie and I are.
You think you've got this whole thing psyched out. You and you, Paul. Gang up on me, right?
It's logic, John.
John Rourke looked at Paul Rubenstein, then nodded his head. He didn't look at his son.
Shit. You'll need to swap clothes with Martin. We'll have to measure exactly where that first bullet went in relationship to Martin's left trouser leg, so we can put a bullet hole there that will correspond.
Then we'll have to smear some of the blood from the fresh wound onto the old hole.
Natalia already said she'd fire the shot.
Oh, you got her in on this too, did you? Is Annie in on this thing as well?
Paul looked away, and Michael just smiled. His chest was bigger than Martin's, his biceps were also larger, and his triceps were better developed. And when they exchanged clothes, he noticed something else. Martin was not circumcised. At the time that Michael Rourke was born, popular wisdom held that it was sound medical practice to circumcise all boys, so he had been circumcised.
When that Jewish thing that they did to you... I've read about the practice. Don't be fooled. The first time anyone sees you...
Well, tell me, Brother Martin. You run around in the nude a lot in front of your soldiers? Didn't think you were that kind of a guy.
Laugh while you can, Michael. Laugh while you can.
Michael looked down at himself. The clothes were a decent enough fit, he supposed, but not to his liking. The trousers weren't too sturdy looking. The shoes, rather than boots, expensive looking, but not too practical. And the shirt, which had little dots in the material, looked more like something a woman would wear.
You know, you may look like a Rourke, Martin. May have the same genes, the same blood, the whole thing. But do you know what a real Rourke would have done? No. What? You don't want this impersonation to succeed, right? So you should have done something to make these clothes of yours unwearable. Here's a good 20th century word for you, Martin. Chump. What's a chump? Somebody who acts stupid, Martin. Like you, buying all this Nazi garbage from Dietrich Zimmer. Why don't you just straighten out, Michael? You and Dad and Sister Annie and that disgusting Jew she's married to would just... Annie's husband is the best friend I have in the world. He's more of a brother to me than you'd ever be, asshole.
Michael grabbed up his sweater before Martin could put it on. Let Martin freeze. The sweater could help to keep one of the women a little warmer. Michael Rourke knew a bit more about Martin now, having listened a little more closely to how Martin talked.
I'll do it.
Annie spoke to Natalia.
I am fine. My eye is steady and so's my hand.
Then Natalia looked at Michael. He was standing there, waiting, just a few feet from her.
This is great. Just great.
What's great?
The girl I love and my sister. What are they doing? Arguing over which one of them is going to get to shoot me.
Stand perfectly still, Michael.
If the enemy didn't show up reasonably quickly, he would freeze to death, Michael Rourke decided. He walked as best he could to keep the blood circulating in his feet. But the two leg wounds, Natalia's shallower than the first, were hurting badly, and walking was becoming increasingly more difficult for him. His head wound, unbandaged, ached. His father had examined it, pronouncing it superficial, but it didn't hurt less because of that. Michael Rourke took some little consolation from the fact that if he died, until enemy medical personnel were able to take a retinal print and check his DNA, he might very well have everyone convinced that Martin had died instead, unless someone who knew better noticed his circumcision. Such a deception, even in death, would slow up the search for his father, his sister, Natalia, and Paul. He'd considered that possibility before, but had never mentioned it to anyone. It had been hard enough as it was, getting his father to agree to this potentially suicidal charade. He'd been talking to himself as he walked and waited, trying to think like Martin Zimmer and talk like Martin Zimmer. Fortunately, the former proved impossible, but he convinced himself he was really getting the hang of the latter. Martin's voice, essentially identical to his father's and his own, was just a little nasal, and he strung words together almost as if he had learned English as a second language, however well. Before his father and mother became so critically injured that their only hope for survival had been cryogenic sleep, Michael had learned a good bit of German. Natalia spoke it fluently, and so had Maria Leuden, the girl with whom he'd slept, the girl he'd kept as his mistress, but had realized he didn't love. And suddenly, Michael Rourke stopped walking. It was the first time he'd actually thought of Maria Leuden since awakening from cryogenic sleep to discover that his mother was still deep in a coma, but that his father, whose brainwave patterns had returned to normal, was being awakened as well. And he realized now, 125 years later, Maria was dead, and so were her children, if she'd had any. His father had kept a considerable collection of books at the retreat, some of them science fiction. Michael Rourke remembered reading one that was about a time traveler. The man had gone forward into the future, but everyone he had known and loved was long dead and gone when he got there. Michael Rourke was luckier than that man. Yet, he promised himself someday, if he made it out of this, he would go to New Germany and find Maria's grave. And he would take Natalia with him. He would put flowers on Maria's grave. It hadn't been love. There was love with Madison, his wife, who was killed so long ago. And there was love, even more intense, with Natalia. But he had cared for Maria Lloyden. It consumed the better part of an hour for them to reach the height of the Rift Valley Wall, and John Rourke had no way of knowing if, when they reached there, it would be radiation-free. On both sides of the Rift Valley, there were hot spots, which would remain hot for centuries to come. Any living thing that ventured there would die sooner or later as a result. But there was also a trail on this side, information about which Natalia and Annie had extracted, how he didn't want to know, from Boris, the head of the slavers, whom they had kidnapped for the specific purpose of getting that information. Part of the trail, a secret route without risk of residual radiation hazard, came very close to the Rift Valley Wall, while other parts were several miles to the west. If they arrived at the height of the wall in a hot spot, they would have to go down again, continue along, then try the climb again. He would not put the women through it a second time unless he was sure, but time was against them, and he'd taken the chance, a calculated risk he could confirm or deny with the radiation meter. Rourke left Annie, Natalia, and the 24 women about 50 feet below, and with Paul beside him, he took the climb, and of course, he left Martin.
You worried about Michael? We're all worried about him, John.
Paul clung to a spit of rock, his feet wedged against the rocky shale below it.
Yeah, I know that. He's tough. He's got a good head on his shoulders. If anybody could pull it off, Michael could.
Is he right? You plan to trade Martin?
If Dietrich Zimmer is too old to perform an operation on Sarah, if his hand isn't steady anymore, then he would have taught someone else's technique, just in case he needed them, or Martin needed them in order to stay alive.
Suppose he saves Sarah's life. What then?
I'll keep my word and release Martin to him. And then, I'll hunt them both down and kill them.
John Rourke kept climbing.
Martin, it's me, Gunther.
Michael Rourke looked at the face of the man who spoke. It was a plain face, the only feature that was remarkable, quite remarkable, being the eyes. They were bright blue, a lighter shade than Natalia's, but nearly as striking. And they were set with epicanthic folds. The man was an officer in the Eden Defense Forces. The embroidered name tag on the parka he wore read Hong.
Gunther?
Then Michael said nothing for a long moment, collecting his thoughts. The last thing he remembered was sitting down, because he was so tired and his legs hurt so badly from the gunshot wounds. The wounds were minor, superficial scratches, but there was still pain. That pain returned to him now, as did the full import of why he was looking up into this strange man's eyes. Michael forced himself to sit up, the man named Gunther Hong and two other men, one an officer, one a senior non-com, assisting him. A fourth man, another senior non-com, brought blankets, laying one over Michael's lower body and wrapping the other around his shoulders and upper body.
What happened to you, Martin?
The coughing was unnecessary, but calculated to plant an idea into the minds of these men. That idea was that if Martin's voice sounded just a little off, perhaps it was because he was coming down with something.
There was a sudden storm. The Russian woman at the controls of the machine, she cannot manage to land the thing properly. There was a fire. I grabbed a gun and jumped when we neared the ground. One of the bastards shot at me. I got these, damn it. Did you think I was waiting out here freezing to death merely for the pure joy of it?
Well, no, but we...
Where were you?
We couldn't find you by aircraft, and...
Help me up.
We have a stretcher, Martin.
I will walk.
Feeling returned rapidly to the wounds in his legs, but his feet were numb, and so were his hands. His head ached. He knew that was from the cold as well, his body rattling with the chill as a means of generating warmth.
I will need a doctor to tend to my injuries. We leave for Eden City at once. See to it. Swine escape, but they cannot have gotten far. I want the search concentrated to the southeast. They will think we anticipate an attempt to reach their co-conspirators in Eden. What they do not know is that I heard the younger of the two who looked like me saying that they had transportation waiting to take them to the Gulf Coast. They will move east to escape the Rift Valley, then likely move directly south.
Wouldn't they try to get to Eden?
These men with my face. The older one of the two is John Thomas Rourke. He has survived for over 6 centuries, man. He has accomplished this by doing the unexpected. You have your orders. Now follow them.
Michael no longer had to feign anger. The pain in his legs sparked the real thing with each step that took him closer to the nearest of the massive battle machines. As Martin Zimmer, he was given the commander's cabin aboard the mobile fortress. The cabin was under no circumstances spacious, but it was more than adequate for one man. Rather than a bunk, the bed was a full-size one, and Michael Rourke leaned back into it now, his eyes closed as the Eden Force's doctor, who seemed competent enough, tended his wounds. Gunther Hong, whom Michael now realized was Martin's personal military advisor and held the rank of Brigadier General, stood at the bedside.
You should take something, Martin, for the pain.
Taking something for the pain might also loosen his tongue, and Michael Rourke couldn't risk that.
No. As soon as this is finished, I must get to Eden.
We'll be out of the Rift Valley and in one of the safe zones in 27 minutes. There's a high-speed aircraft that will touch down at the same time. You will be in Eden in less than 2 hours, Martin, but why—
With John Rourke alive, there is no choice but to act at once.
Perhaps I should contact the Herr Doctor, Martin.
Michael Rourke looked squarely at Gunther Hong. Did Hong mean Dietrich Zimmer? But there was no way to ask, and if he even seemed interested in the subject, that interest might betray him. Instead, he snapped at the doctor who was cleaning the gunshot wound given him by Natalia.
Clumsy fool! You are causing me discomfort! Be done with this! I must reach Eden City and be able to act!
He'd ordered that clothing be brought for him and hoped that it would also mean a weapon. The Eden Origin assault rifle that was with Michael when they found him was nothing he could overtly attempt to hold on to, and his pistols had been left with his family. Michael looked at the watch on his left wrist. It was Martin's watch, similar in size to his own Rolex, but digital rather than analog. The case and the band seemed to be made of gold. Although it was obviously quite expensive, Michael preferred his own timepiece. Martin's watch showed 18 minutes before the hour. By 10 minutes after the hour, if the Eden war machine was punctual, he'd be airborne for Eden City. The clothing arrived, military-looking. And there was a pistol belt and a holster. Before Michael Rourke could say anything, Gunther Hong spoke.
When we took up the chase, Martin, I ordered that some of your things be brought along.
Good.
The doctor was finished patching up the gunshot wounds and had pronounced Michael's hands and feet not frostbitten.
Doctor, out! This thing with John Rourke and his son and the Russian women and the others. I do not want John Rourke to become a rallying point for the dissidents of Eden. For that reason, once the rendezvous with the aircraft has been met, I wish for you to take personal charge in the field of efforts to capture or kill John Rourke. You are loyal to me. This is known. You must obey these orders.
Yes, Martin. If it is your will.
Michael Rourke nodded as, with some awkwardness, he swung his bare legs over the side of the bed.
Bring me my things. I must prepare.
Gunther Hong complied, moving off quickly to the chair and returning with an armful of rather nondescript attire. There was a dark gray Nehru-style jacket, which he had first seen in videotape movies from the 1960s, where people wore clothing variously referred to as mod or kicky. A maroon turtleneck shirt, tight-looking blue trousers, and short black boots completed the outfit. There was a new set of underwear, too. The dressings on his leg were waterproof, and there was time remaining.
I need to shower.
In here, Martin.
Hong pointed toward a small door off the side of the cabin. Michael nodded, taking the clothing and starting toward the door. Once inside the bathroom, he stripped away the remainder of Martin's things, then entered the shower stall. He washed his hair twice, soaking his body under the steaming water for a very long time. He was still chilled to the bone. On the plus side, his leg wounds were still bandaged, and the cut on his head only bothered him when he touched it. Senior officers of Eden lived well in the field, he concluded. The bathroom was far from Spartan. If he ran out of time, it wasn't as if the aircraft would leave without him. He was, after all, Martin Zimmer. Michael Rourke smiled at the thought as he continued to enjoy the hot water. If he had to pick one person in the world not to be, it would be Martin Zimmer. Biological brother or not, the man was evil incarnate. The key to Michael's success in the role, however, was to reach Eden City. Then, with only a man or two with him, go someplace, any place, lose, neutralize, or kill, if need be, the men, and get away. The longer he hung around pretending to be Martin Zimmer, the greater his chances of being discovered. Michael toweled dry, then started to dress. Martin Zimmer's trousers were a little loose at the waist and tight at the thighs, the fashionable men of Eden evidently being into underdeveloped muscles or looking as though their pants were about to rip. The trousers were also beltless. Except for a revolver on a hip grip or the clip type inside the waistband holsters, this made carrying a gun at the waist rather awkward. The turtleneck was somewhat tight as well, but satisfactory. He slipped into the high-collar jacket with no lapels. As long as he did not attempt to close the garment across his chest, it fit all right. There was a hat that presumably went with the outfit. It was reminiscent of hats he'd seen worn by Mao Zedong in photographs. Michael Rourke looked at it in disgust, just carrying it in his hand instead of wearing it as he exited the bathroom.
I have a gun for you, Martin.
Hong was holding a gun belt in his outstretched right hand. Michael Rourke didn't react instantly. The clothing he wore, Martin Zimmer's clothing, was obviously not designed for convenient concealment of a firearm. Nor did people travel openly armed in Eden City. As much as Michael Rourke wanted a gun, he was convinced Martin Zimmer would not have taken it.
That is what I have the defense forces for, isn't it?
But he'd be damned if he'd wear the hat. They started from the borrowed cabin toward the rendezvous with the aircraft, Michael presumed. As they moved through the bowels of the mobile fortress, men everywhere at their assigned tasks, Michael pondered something that had disturbed him from the very moment he first realized who Martin Zimmer was. Did Zimmer cultivate the near worship of John Rourke as some sort of evil joke? There were statues everywhere in Eden, most particularly the one of his father, Martin's father too, atop the retreat. John Rourke's face was on the coinage, the stamps, even the health certificates. Why? And why did Martin Zimmer conceal his own face from all but a few? Snow fell heavily from a low, overcast gray sky. Each step was difficult, the terrain beneath their feet rocky and uneven, yet masked with more than a foot of reasonably fresh snow. In the distance, to the east, the cloud cover was continually rent by chain lightning over the Rift Valley. They were on the trail. That was pure luck, of course, intersecting the trail after the first climb. But a little luck, of the good kind, seemed long overdue them. Natalia and Annie stayed with 23 of the women rescued from the fortress of the land pirates. John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein carried the 24th woman, injured during the crash of the helicopter, between them on a litter. This woman had the same chances for survival that the other women had. If shelter and food could be found soon, she would live. Otherwise, she would not. To have used their radios to contact Allied intelligence, assuming with all the electrical activity not far away in the Rift Valley the radios would have worked at all, would have been to invite capture by Eden forces and the land pirates. The portion of the trail they followed led west, and technically at least, was not part of Eden. Centuries ago, before the night of the war, it had been known as Arkansas. Because of the starkness of the terrain, nothing looked familiar, and it was frequently necessary to check the compass and the map to make certain they didn't stray from the trail. No caves or large rock croppings presented themselves, so there was no place for shelter, not just from the cold, but also from aerial observation. Because they were well enough away from the Rift Valley and the freak electrical storms now, the Eden gunships could operate with impunity. John Rourke watched as Natalia came forward with Annie and one of the freed women. She was very thin, with deep circles under dark, fearful eyes. The woman kept her head slightly down, the result being that her eyes did not meet John Rourke's as he looked at her. Martin Zimmer stood between Natalia and Annie, an evil-looking smile on his face, his hands clasped on his upper arms, rubbing himself for warmth.
Why don't you just leave her, Dad?
Let's set the lady down.
Rourke dropped to one knee beside her.
We're only stopping to rest for a minute. You're doing fine.
John Rourke walked a few feet from her as Annie began to speak.
Daddy, we were talking back there, and Marianne... Oh, this is Marianne.
Again, John Rourke tried to meet the dark, furtive eyes of the woman, but she almost seemed intrigued with studying the toes of her worn cloth shoes instead.
Tell them, Marianne. Tell them what you told us.
I didn't mean to cause no trouble.
John Rourke judged her age to be 20, if that, but she seemed as careworn as a woman three times her age might be.
This isn't causing trouble if you know something that'll help us.
The girl did not speak.
Is it something about where we are, or what?
Her lips were cracked, the bottom one swollen a little, as if she'd been struck. He'd noticed before the crash that many of the women kept by the land pirates for slavery and sex appeared physically abused beyond overwork and malnutrition.
My pa always told me to keep my mouth shut.
Well, I don't know about your father's motivation for that, Marianne.
Being silent is inappropriate under the circumstances. We're all in this together, and if you know something that will enable us to get out of this more easily, you should tell us. Do you understand?
She was drawing in the dirt with her toes, swaying her body back and forth to some sort of unheard rhythm. But she nodded her head. Her fingers played with the tattered fabric of her dress. She didn't look up as she spoke.
I come from round here, mister.
John Rourke said nothing for a moment.
Over that ridge, I think. Ain't sure. Maybe's the town.
Town?
He doubted her description of the place as an actual town. Aerial photos he'd studied indicated isolated collections of buildings, but there were no large human habitations within at least 50 miles of their current position. Still, if she were right, some small hamlet on the other side of the ridge might be possessed of a vehicle, or even horses. Even the smallest vehicle or a solitary horse would allow them to make contact with Allied intelligence and get real help. There was a resistance movement within Eden, of course, and there were personnel affiliated with it in the Wildlands as well.
Let her take you to her little town. It'll make you easier to find.
Why don't you act like a human being?
Do you have people in your town? Family, I mean?
Uh-huh.
Do you think somebody there might be able to loan us a vehicle or a horse? Just for a little while, Marianne.
Maybe.
And your town is just over that ridge, right? Not much further than that?
Marianne nodded. Rourke looked back toward the remainder of the women. The 22, all huddled together for warmth a few yards away, would cover the distance that he judged to the ridge and over in perhaps a hard day's march. He could cover that distance much more quickly, and he wondered about Marianne. His enormous body was resplendent with weapons, guns, and knives. The uniform of the land pirates was no uniform at all, but this man, flanked by two other men of lesser height and bulk, and not nearly so well armed, was uniformed. He wore a coat with an enormous cape, which to Michael was reminiscent of Basil Rathbone's habitual attire as Sherlock Holmes in the video movies John Rourke had collected at the retreat. This man was obviously the leader of the land pirates. The retreat's video collection, which was temporarily unavailable to them, might best be described as eclectic. Michael Rourke's father had everything, from the profound to the frivolous, from science to drama to comedy. There were a number of the Sherlock Holmes films featuring Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. The giant land pirate further brought to mind the Holmesian image because of the pipe he smoked, large bowled with a recurving stem. But beyond the pipe and coat, nothing else was remotely civilized or gentlemanly. His overall appearance was otherwise closer to that of a dirty-looking grizzly bear, and the image of a bear was certainly more appropriate to his size. The apparent leader of the land pirates was enormous.
Elmo Babinski wants to apologize for what happened, Martin. He says his men failed miserably.
That was the name supplied to them by Allied intelligence. Michael quickly ran the few facts he possessed through his mind. Like the preponderance of the land pirates, although many were German and an almost equal number were of Second City Chinese extraction, Babinski was of Soviet origin, likely from the underground city. Mentioning his name in the Wildlands supposedly struck terror in even the bravest heart, because Babinski, it was reported, seemed to enjoy cruelty. Babinski stood now on the deck of the mobile fortress, his sheer bulk almost blocking the entrance to the waiting aircraft.
His security sucked, and you know it. Maybe I should tell him to kiss my ass.
Martin, remember, please, that we need his manpower. If you offend him now, I don't know.
Remember this. If he did not fear me, he would not be here.
Michael increased his stride, Gunther Hong keeping up with him, until he stopped a few feet from Elmo Babinski and the two underlings. The wind that swept across the main deck of the fortress was bitterly cold, and whatever warmth he'd regained in the hot shower was long gone.
So?
Michael stared directly into Babinski's face. Babinski's eyes were overly large and a muddy brown in color, and they went with the bear image very nicely. The eyes flickered, the stare wavering.
I came to say that I'm damn sorry.
You do not know how right you are.
Babinski's body seemed to tense, and for a moment, Michael thought he had overplayed his hand.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Martin. We'll help your men get that dirty bastard Rourke, and I'll bring you his fucking head on a stick if you want it.
Fine, you do that. I'm very cold and wish to board my aircraft. Good hunting.
Michael started forward, but Babinski did not move. Michael stopped and looked up at him.
Well?
I will kill John Rourke for you, Martin.
Michael said nothing. Babinski stepped aside. As Michael climbed the ramp toward the fuselage, he realized his fists were clenching. Marianne would not walk abreast of them, and Natalia wondered if it were the girl's upbringing, or her period of slavery at the stronghold of the land pirates, or both, which made her so deferential to men. Natalia walked beside John Rourke. They set a vigorous pace. Despite her emaciated appearance, the rescued girl, Marianne, was, oddly enough, able to match it, and Natalia realized that it might well be that the girl ran on some sort of mental ether, just because returning home to family and loved ones would soon be a reality. The girl was out of earshot, in any event. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna had been at once waiting for and dreading the opportunity now presented to her, but she used it.
I need to talk with you, John.
Well, I always like talking to you. I suspect I always will. But there's nothing you have to say to me, okay?
They had been walking for well over an hour, and as Natalia looked back, she could no longer even see the lightning over the Rift Valley. By now, Paul and Annie, along with Martin Zimmer and the other women, would be moving again, following them. John had made the right decision. Go on ahead, find transportation of some sort, see if transportation could be brought back for the women, or, at the least, bring clothing and food. While one of them did that, the other could go for help.
Everyone thought...
Look!
Let me say it, damn it, John! All right, I was alone. You and Sarah were in this sleep again. I never had any intention of taking this sleep again myself. I told myself that maybe it was fate or something. Can you imagine how awkward I felt? I was in love with you, and you were in love with me, and there was Sarah. You loved her, and she became my friend? I mean, I was... There was just...
I understand. I approve.
Damn it, John! You approve? We didn't take this sleep, Michael and I, so you could approve or disapprove. We took it so we could tell you. You would wake up sometime in the future and find out what happened to me and to Michael, and who knows what you would think. I owe you an explanation. You do not owe me approval. I was lonely. Michael was there.
Look!
No! You look, John! It's not that I attached myself to Michael because you were no longer around. Don't ever think that. I love you, but I love Michael. I did not realize that until after you were gone, and then I had a choice. I cannot be like you. I'm not that good. Maybe I'm too human. My life was meaningless, and there was Michael. And when he made love to me the first time...
I don't want to hear it, all right?
No. No, you have to. So you will understand. I was afraid. I was terrified that I'd be telling myself it was you making love to me, like I had always wanted you to. But when it happened, it was Michael. In reality and in my mind. I never gave myself to anyone like that before, and...
John stopped walking, his hands going to her arms, turning her around abruptly to face him.
Look, maybe you don't want my approval, but you're gonna get it anyway. I love you. I have since the first time I saw you, but it wouldn't work for us. Sure, things have been different, but they weren't. We can still be friends, we can still have that kind of love. I'm happy for you, and I'm happy for Michael. And maybe when Sarah awakens, comes out of it, when she has that operation, then maybe Sarah and I can live just like two...
He started to turn away from her. Natalia broke free of his hands, threw her arms around his neck, and drew his head down. He bent it toward her easily. She held him. Natalia knew the words he had been about to say. They were her dream, too. The words he couldn't say without weeping were simple words, ordinary words, but they did not apply. She doubted they ever would to John and Sarah, to Paul and Annie, to Michael and herself, either.
Normal people.
Normal people from the era in which they were born and had all died one morning, except for those who were already dead, or those who hid within the ground to die and raise another generation to die, and so on for centuries. Normal people died. Michael Rourke listened. Gunther Hong talked.
We can turn this thing with Rourke to our advantage, Martin. You should see what the Herr Doctor thinks about it.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean Babinski and his lieutenants know about Rourke, and of course the women taken from Babinski's people. And I'm sure there are some others, but once he's taken care of,
I don't see it as distracting at all from the messianic thing you and Dr. Zimmer are planning. I mean, anyone who's seen him will think he's seen you, except those few who know. And we can always liquidate Babinski. Like we talked about, if he becomes bothersome, we'll test a warhead out there. There'd be little to lose in a country like that. Just wait until the winds are right.
Messiah.
It is interesting, Martin. You've got to admit that. I mean, maybe this will push up the timetable a little bit, but hey, he couldn't possibly realize it, of course, but John Rourke is almost helping you out. And the son, too. There's the body you need.
Michael didn't say anything. He shifted in his seat to cover the effect of the chill which ran along his spine. Dietrich Zimmer's right eye moved over the computer screen. On the hard disk, he had every bit of data that he felt was extant concerning the life of Dr. John Thomas Rourke. Like himself, John Rourke's doctorate was in medicine, but Dietrich Zimmer doubted that their skills could at all be compared. In the 20th century, when Rourke had learned the trade, medicine had been little better than sophisticated witch doctoring, and John Rourke had once been a case officer with the American Central Intelligence Agency. There was no telling how good Rourke was at that, but that he lived to leave the occupation at least said something for him. Rourke was a survivalist, prior to what was universally called the Night of the War. He wrote and taught survival skills to military and police personnel around the globe, and he was a weapons expert. Rourke was a peculiar man, his apparent tastes hardly describable as merely eclectic. The music in the retreat ranged quite literally from Beethoven to the Beatles. One of the books Rourke liberated from the retreat upon his return to the land of the living was Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. The book was banned in Eden, of course. Martin should have pulled that copy as well. Dietrich Zimmer had met John Rourke once, more than a century and a quarter ago. Their meeting had been very brief, taking place in a hospital corridor, and their meeting had been very violent. At the time, he had wanted John Rourke dead and thought that goal had been achieved. It turned out otherwise. Zimmer still wanted Rourke dead, and he would correct past errors in due course in order to achieve that goal now, 125 years later. But in those intervening years, John Thomas Rourke had slept. John Rourke had sustained injuries in that corridor, which had nearly claimed his life. Had it not been for cryogenic sleep, those injuries would have ended Rourke's life. Cryogenic sleep's peculiar side effect, Zimmer himself had discovered through his own experience, was physical rejuvenation. Even though cryogenic sleep was not some myth-like fountain of youth, which would have been wonderful, it did erase much of the toll of the years, strengthening the body and the mind to go on even stronger than before. At the time of that encounter in the hospital corridor, a few moments before Martin was born to Sarah Rourke and Dietrich Zimmer shot her in the head, Zimmer had been 34. He took cryogenic sleep 12 years later. In those 12 years, Dietrich Zimmer had meticulously raised young Martin as his own son, his finest experiment. Escaping with the boy after killing the fortuitously available second infant, Dietrich Zimmer found asylum in a modest but adequate encampment that he had prepared as a last refuge. The site was in a remote portion of what was once known as Brazil. With the assistance of several loyal Nazi comrades, he accomplished the required genetic surgery to alter the Rourke child and make him his own. The result proved to be all he had hoped it would, except for Albert Heimacher's tendency toward petulance, which Martin unfortunately displayed. And perhaps that had been a characteristic of Adolf Hitler as well. Some accounts alluded to the trait. The result was a boy he raised as Martin Zimmer, with the mental and physical capacities of John Thomas Rourke spliced to the genes of the greatest leader in human history, Adolf Hitler. Heimacher, the source of the genetic material, was a direct descendant of the Führer through the Reichskinder program. After 12 years of intensive education utilizing the most dynamic techniques then available, it was time for them both to sleep. The seeds of change were planted in Eden, and as Dietrich Zimmer had hoped, the intervening years allowed those seeds to take hold and flourish. Dietrich Zimmer had awakened 18 years ago. And he had awakened Martin Zimmer, his son now, in order to complete the boy's education and make him ready for power. Although Dietrich Zimmer's age was best calculated at 64, according to comparative data, he was as fit as a healthy man of 50. And this was adequate to his purpose as counselor to the new Hitler. Cryogenic sleep not only rejuvenated the body, but in direct proportion to the duration of sleep, it prolonged the lifespan. Perhaps John Rourke suspected that. Rourke slept 5 centuries between what was commonly called the Night of the War and the period in which the Great War between the Allies and the opposing Soviet culture was concluded. Then Rourke slept for another 1.25 centuries. The effect of 625 years in cryogenic sleep on a human body such as Rourke seemed to possess could not be calculated. The computer model Dietrich Zimmer constructed indicated strongly that barring catastrophic illness or violent death, John Rourke would live well beyond the normal human lifespan, maintaining youthful vigor for a vastly extended period of time as well. What if each year lost were a year gained? Zimmer's body shuddered with that thought. And the same scenario, more or less, held for the rest of the Rourke family. And then there was Sarah Rourke, young Martin's mother. Try as he had since his own return to life 18 years ago, Dietrich Zimmer found himself unable to locate the cocoons in which the sleepers rested. But he knew there were 2 more. In 1 chamber slept Sarah Rourke, a bullet lodged deep within her brain. As long as John Rourke lived, Dietrich Zimmer wanted Sarah Rourke to live as well, but not a moment longer. Because John Rourke had to know that the only man alive who possessed the surgical skills and techniques sufficient to remove the bullet was the man who had put it there. And that man could not be killed. To do so, for John Rourke to kill him, would be to sentence Sarah Rourke to sleep forever in something like death, perhaps even worse than death. The remaining sleeping chamber held the odd man out. Colonel Wolfgang Mann, field commander for the victorious Allied armies, was that man. Why had he abandoned the adulation of New Germany for the uncertainty of cryogenic sleep? Did he lust after one of the women? What was the answer? But the survival of Wolfgang Mann provided an excellent opportunity for revenge. Mann, with the considerable aid of the Rourke family, toppled the National Socialist regime of New Germany. And under Dieter Bern, there was established a democratic republic dedicated to stamping out forever National Socialism as the driving force of New Germany. That form of government still endured in New Germany, and Nazism in New Germany was all but extinct today. That, too, would change. Dietrich Zimmer glanced through the file. There was data concerning John Rourke's relationship with the Russian woman, Natalia Tyomarovna. But there was also data indicating that while John Rourke had slept in the relatively insignificant period of time before his family joined him, the Russian woman and Rourke's son, Michael, became lovers. As much as Zimmer would have wished, he did not consider it likely that he could use this development to drive a wedge between father and son. At best, they might hate each other privately, but never question being allied against anyone perceived as the common enemy. And there was Annie, the only daughter of John and Sarah Rourke, wife of the Jew Paul Rubinstein. From what Dietrich Zimmer had learned of her, she possessed many of her father's skills, and Annie Rubinstein had the peculiar ability that was referred to in the literature as remote viewing. Evidently, if the data was correct, she could see things that by all logic and reason she should not be able to see through the use of her mind alone. If he could get her, he might experiment with her before killing her. But her husband would die instantly, of course. If there was an emotional link involved with her remote viewing capabilities, it might prove enriching to observe her reactions as Paul Rubinstein was killed. There was a slowly growing Jewish population on the earth again. Dietrich Zimmer vowed to correct that. Some Jews had remained clandestinely practicing their faith in the Soviet underground city in the Ural Mountains. Midwake, the American citadel beneath the sea, had included Jews in its population as well. Despite his being a Jew, Rubinstein was very clever, Dietrich Zimmer was perfectly willing to admit. But clever Jews died as surely as dull ones, Zimmer smiled to himself. Clearly, when he succeeded in killing John Rourke, he would have to kill Michael Rourke and Natalia Tyomarovna and Annie and Paul Rubinstein at the same time. Otherwise, the 4 surviving members of the Rourke family would become even more formidable enemies than before.
Enter!
It was Grundig, his general assistant.
Yes, Grundig, what is it?
Doctor, there was a crisis, but it has been resolved.
I am happy to hear that, Grundig. Its nature?
Your son.
Martin?
He is all right, Doctor. The Rourke family invaded the stronghold of the land pirates. Your son was kidnapped.
He what?
He escaped. He returns even now to Eden City. He sustained no serious injury.
Curiosity drove people beyond normal bounds. So did revenge. Dietrich Zimmer knew this from personal experience. Revenge and curiosity were his life force.